Well, I know a number of heroic souls here this evening. Survived the inclemency of the occasion. We hope that you will be glad you made the effort. This evening we have a story that differs considerably from the ones we have previously selected. And in this treatment tonight, we cannot hope to cover the countless interpretations that have been associated with the Faust myth. Therefore, we are going to select one which perhaps is not as frequently discussed as the others, and add in such implications and extensions as time permits. In this story, we have a new group of highly symbolical factors. Part of the story lies in its historical orientation because it belongs to a very important period in the transitional life of early modern man. Part of its fascination also lies in its psychological implications. And these we will attempt to analyze briefly. But to first things first. The Faust myth, as we know it, has a rather complicated and confusing origin. Actually, the elements of the story are, many of them, very ancient. But they gradually came to be centered upon a possibly historical person, Dr. Faustus, a curious man of many interesting attributes, who is believed to have lived in the 15th century, at a time when to think at all was to be suspected of sorcery, and to be a well-ordered thinker was to be regarded as in league with the devil. Thus, the fame of poor old Dr. Faust, like that of Cagliostro, rests not so much upon what he did as what was done to him, both actually and symbolically. From what little we know of the original man, he seems to have been a rather quiet, orderly scholar who lived a comparatively uninteresting life, with one exception. And perhaps from this hangs the whole tale. In a time when such things apparently were not done, he trained a dog. Now this in itself was a very terrible mistake as far as the reputation of a reputable college professor was concerned. He had a dog that would do tricks. This dog would, on command, lie down, roll over, sit on his hind legs and beg for food. It was obvious to any respectable person of the time that this dog had to be a demon in disguise, because ordinary dogs did not behave in this contrary to canine manner. And as a result of having trained a dog, this poor old gentleman came into very ill repute. Apparently he had one or two other oddities of temperament also. But this one was irrefutable evidence that he was not normal. Of course, today, in a day of pets and in a time when we have seeing eye dogs and dogs in circuses and everything, it's hard to imagine what a hard reputation could arise from such a slight cause. But this, plus local gossip, got the poor doctor into a serious dilemma. And gradually he came to be identified as the perfect magician. Probably he added to his dog training proclivities an interest in certain subjects then not regarded as quite honorable. He was a Kabbalist, he dabbled in astrology, and may even have gone so far as to try to compound the Philosopher's Stone. Thus, to his demoniacal interests were added another, classification. He was a lunatic. He was concerned in secret arts and so forth, which not only were not respectable, but were impossible. So by degrees his madness grew, and with it his fame. It is said, of course, that in the end this poor, kindly man was carried away to the underworld by his attendant demon. This was accompanied by many signs and wonders. Perhaps we must discount some of them because the occurrence took place immediately after a convivial gathering of professors and old students, during which a number of them were unable to remember exactly what occurred. But in this convivial occasion, the doctor disappeared, and the history of the gentleman ceases to be of any great moment to us. So out of this incident came a story which has been dramatized and has inspired some of the most remarkable productions in the literary history of Western symbolical writing. But of course, the masterpiece of all these works is the poem by Goethe, which becomes the basis of the opera, which makes use of sections from the first part of the poem. Before, however, we go on now to analyze the significance of the total piece, we must get a certain cast of characters in order, and we must try to understand exactly what they imply, because from one symbolism we can pass to another, and once we have a certain key, we can expand this into almost any field of activity that we so desire. The study of grimoires and other works on black magic relating to the medieval period present us, first of all, with an extraordinary psychological situation, a situation that arose from the benightedness of the times, from the gradual collapse of earlier cultural systems, the almost complete prevalence of illiteracy, and numerous other negative vicissitudes. During this time, marked, of course, by such official pronouncements as the Malus Maleficarum, or the Hammer of Evil, and things of that nature, it was firmly believed in Europe that demons not only existed, but existed primarily to plague the righteous. It was not uncommon to find beautifully carved imps sticking their wooden heads out from under the edges of pews, and it was believed that you were not safe even in church. Some are even of the opinion you were least safe there. It was all in a point of view. Also, no one went out at night, because not only were there demons under the doorsteps, but they might be lurking anywhere, even in the breast of your nearest and dearest friend. Also, these demons, if they did nothing else to you, exposed you to fresh air, which was regarded as a deadly poison at that time, perhaps due to the fact that there was very little of it, due to the prevailing custom of dumping the garbage into the middle of the streets. In the days of the glory of Florence, in the days of the mighty Florentines, all refuse was thrown into the middle of the streets at night, and the streets were scavenged with swine, who were driven through in packs to clean the streets, and the next day the swine were killed for food. It was really a happy, optimistic situation, considerably prior to the time of the Puritan drug laws. This led to an interesting custom that we still maintain, and that is that when a lady and gentleman walk on the street, it is customary for the gentleman to walk on the side toward the curb. This was because it was the most dangerous side when things were being thrown out of the windows. Many of our common habits arise from such unsuspected sources. In any event, Europe was in a very bad condition, and the situation was complicated by what we call today the Protestant Reformation. Now, most liberal thinkers feel that this was the great decision between Martin Luther and the church. But much more was involved than this, because we have to realize that the Reformation took place at a time when not only man did not know what Reformation meant, but was scarcely equipped to sustain a general Reformation of any kind, personal or collective. And so the Reformation produced a whole series of consequences, which certainly were not intended, but were nevertheless extremely important in the psychological story of the modern world. The first thing the Reformation did, obviously, was to break the tradition between medieval man and the church. Now this, however, was merely a physical break. It did not represent truly a psychological break. The abuses and fanaticisms against which the individual rebelled were essentially within himself. And after he had ceased to be a fanatical member of the old denominations, he became a fanatical member of the new denominations. His fanaticism was not touched by the Reformation itself. He did not change as a person. But he made a series of discoveries. And these discoveries influenced his entire psychological life. When the Reformation began to take on serious proportions, the church thundered its anathemas against the reformers. It did everything possible to destroy them and succeeded in eliminating a good many. But it also excommunicated and declared heretical and cast its anathemas wide and far. And to the amazement of everyone involved, nothing happened. Those individuals who had just been excommunicated did not fall dead, as they were expected to do. Their fields did not suddenly become sterile. Their cattle did not run dry. Their own affairs went along very much as before. And it seemed that the sun still shone upon them in the daytime and the stars at night. Now this was a very disconcerting state of affairs. It caused a certain inevitable doubt to arise in the public mind as to how important the anathemas were, because everyone seemed to survive them in fair shape. The moment the anathemas were attacked, the foundation of religion was attacked. It was suddenly obvious, or at least it seemed to be obvious, to these people that this infallible body upon which they had depended for ages and which had kept them under a certain spell was not infallible. Now, if we were thoughtful people in those days and really reasoned things through on the level of fair knowledge and culture, a moderate course might have been followed. But in those days, the ignorant man, as today, is a man of extremes. And when his old faith was shaken, all his faith was shaken simultaneously. And if the old church was not infallible, perhaps there was no infallibility. Perhaps if God did not strike the heretic dead, there was no God. These attitudes of extremism marked this transition period and resulted in a wave of disbelief, of unbelief, a wave of almost forlorn fear, which not only attacked religion, but also attacked the great educational institutions that then flourished under the broad wing of religion. If the church was wrong in its ability, or lacked the ability, to enforce its anathemas, all knowledge might be wrong. Everything could be wrong. There might be nothing to which any human being could cling. A man at that time with nothing to cling to was in a very sorry state, because he lacked resources in himself. He lacked any other direction in which to turn. So the Protestant Reformation led to a series of rather powerful conclusions. One group, after the Reformation, became the square-toed pilgrim, the individual who clung to practically every essential doctrine of the old faith, but removed from it nearly all glamour. He took away art, music. He took away the magnificence of the cathedral. He took away the mass and the great ritual, and found himself in a strangely dull and melancholy kind of faith that became more and more bitter, more and more pessimistic, and more inclined to persecute any dissenters within its own ranks. We find this in the splendid story of the Pilgrim Fathers, who, coming all the way to our western continent to find religious liberty, immediately excommunicated from their own community anyone who differed from them in anything. It was a period of great psychological unrest. And in this period, there began to arise a certain kind of philosophic materialism, which we have called a form of humanism. This humanism was quite different, however, from the idealistic humanism of the 18th and 19th centuries, and very different from the utter materialistic humanism of the 20th century. This humanism was a certain bewilderment in that time. Man suddenly looking out upon a world began to reorient his own relationship with it. In the old days, man was important. Under theology, man was just about the most important thing in the universe. His creation was a special act of God, and when God had created man, God looked around and said, "This is the best work I ever did. I shall never die to improve on it." So that this was the noblest work of God. Man was therefore a special creation. The world in which he lived was a garden that had been given to him. The creatures in it were there to serve him and to supply him with food and clothing. Everything, even the stars and the sky, were to light his way. And when Savonarola questioned whether or not the stars were chandeliers to help folks home at night, he was promptly burned at the stake for questioning such a reasonable and natural hypothesis. Then suddenly came this situation, brought indirectly as the result of the Reformation. Man was nothing. The universe was everything. The world was enormous. The orientations of man were infantile. The question arose, did he know anything? Could he know anything? The whole structure of classical learning was undermined. Men no longer believed in the great traditions that had gone before. And this broad disillusionment stretched itself across the face of learning in every level and in every department. And out of it came gradually this new and entirely different orientation. Man, a poor, naked, unequipped, uninformed creature, helpless and hopeless, in the midst of a vast creation which Galileo and Copernicus had begun to put in order for him. Man was suddenly ignorant. Not only ignorant, but not at all certain that he could ever know. And all of man's problem, his great uncertainty, his confusion, all these things are summed up in the personality of Faust and the sub-Faust, which associates with him in this great allegory. So we are not surprised to find that after the prologue in heaven, we are introduced to Faust himself, a bitter, disillusioned man, a man whose scholarship has led him to naught, a man who is discouraged with all of the ways of learning and wisdom. He has explored, he has sought, he has questioned, he has read the ancient books and studied the old manuscripts. But here he stands with all his lore, a fool no wiser than before. And in these words, Dr. Faust was speaking for 100 or 150 years of European culture at a time when disillusionment and a complete resigning to the hopelessness of ever knowing anything dominated European thinking. Now, out of humanism came the new God, the God that was to make way for the rise of industrialism, the rise of the a posteriori approach to philosophy, the God, the type of thinking that was to pave the way for Bacon, Descartes, Voltaire, and Rousseau. A new kind of world was coming into existence. So we must now begin to study the nature of this world a little. And to do it, we must go back to the source of most of these concepts, particularly in a poetic work of this nature. And we must study our Greek myths, the legendary background. Now, among the Greeks, there was a deity who in those old days was a very kindly, rather good-hearted, good-natured deity. He was a human being, part of his body that of a faun or a satyr. This was the great god Pan, and he lived in the reeds by the river. And here he played upon his shepherd's pipes, and he was the god of nature. And he was the god of the meadows and the valleys and the rich fields of grain. Now, nature to the Greek would naturally be kindly, because he was a nature lover. The Greek was never burdened with a kind of theology that was heavy with mortal sin. He had no such concept of life. To him, worship of the gods was a pleasant affair, to be accompanied by dance and festival, and to be celebrated in the altars, in the groves, and by the roadside, where flowers and fruit were brought to the various homes of the deities and divinities. So this rather kindly, optimistic, extroverted group of people saw in the god Pan a very near and dear friend, because he was with them in the streams, and in the seas, and in the lakes, in the rivers. He was always there, and with the flowers of summer and the wind blowing through the breeze, through the trees, and he was a very congenial type of individual. Now, this deity Pan was usually represented with a human head with rather sharp ears and short blunt horns on his forehead. The upper part of his body was human, but the lower part ended in the hoofs of an animal. He had a short tail which he could waggle very strenuously, and he was particularly fond of running about the countryside, playing with the children and all these things, and when other matters did not interfere, he liked to be a shepherd and to play his flute of seven reeds in the dusk of the evening, where his music could be heard through the hills, echoing happily and rhythmically. Now, when the changes of religious belief came along, there was a saying that with the rise of the church, great Pan died. And such is said to have been the statement of the oracle. But actually, the great Pan did not die, because the new religion wouldn't let him die. Such a pleasant, natural, and terminal condition for the happy god of the valleys was not permitted. One of the early habits that we find among many religious groups, and this goes into all parts of the world, is that the gods of former religions were gradually transformed into the demons of the new religion. Thus, we attempted to cast particular disrepute upon old faiths. So the happy, pleasant, kindly deity Pan was transformed into a demon. He was transformed into a devil with a cloven hoof and horns on his forehead, and his pleasant music was transformed into a kind of dance of death, so that all who followed him lost their souls. This new kind of devil was given a region over which he ruled, a region of chaos, confusion, and destruction, attended by all the nymphs and satyrs and nereids of the old belief, and this region was appropriately called Pandemonium. And we still have the word as a symbol of utter and complete confusion. There was no greater confusion than that which arose concerning Pan himself and what was done to him. Now, in the old medieval demonologies, we have another good example of this same practice of changing gods into demons. The prince of demons, the prince of hell, the prince of darkness, in the days when witchcraft was in flower, was called Beelzebub, the prince of darkness. And he was supposed to be really the number one demon in the entire hierarchy of the damned. Now, his name comes from Baal Zebub, a very ancient Babylonian deity. In fact, the deity Baal of the ancients was really a very good god. In fact, he was the savior god of the Babylonians. And he was represented by an image, much like that of the Memnon in the Egyptian desert, one of which has an Aeolian harp in its head, so that when the wind blows through the openings and the special arranged chambers in the head, the image is made to sing or to make a sound. Therefore, we have the particular attributes of Baal preserved. Baal Zebub, my Lord who sings. And out of my Lord who sings came a being so monstrous and terrifying that it frightened about 300 years of good Christians into an early grave. It was a very sad situation, but all part of a prevailing madness that took some time to subside. Now, Pan, of course, is the origin of our Mephistopheles, who even in the direful and dourest moments of his career of conspiracy proclaims himself in the story of Faust as part of the power that still works for good while ever scheming ill. Mephisto, in this case, the word Mephistopheles has never been adequately derivated. We do not know exactly where it comes from, but we think from a Latin deity, Mephistus, which probably could have originated it, particularly because the Latin deity was a pleasant, cheerful, happy, and benevolent creature, just as far from this monster as you can possibly imagine. Now, why should Mephisto appear in this curious likeness? Why should great Pan take on so monstrous a shape and appear, as he does in the opera, as a gallant cavalier, with his tight-fitting red suit and his black cape and the long feather in his cap and all of the appearance of a man of gentle parts and good character? Actually, with Faust representing the confusion of a collapsing ethical system and the rise of humanism, Mephisto as Pan fits perfectly into the required picture, because Mephisto represents, as Pan did, primarily the physical universe, nature itself, the earth with its mountains and its valleys and its seas. Therefore, the power of Mephisto lay in the fascination of the material world, a fascination which began to take hold of the minds of European thinkers after the Protestant Reformation. Suddenly, man found himself, much as in the story of Robinson Crusoe, where he stands upon a desert island in space and proclaims himself master of all he surveys. And medieval man, emancipated from the clergy, was now master of all he surveyed. And needless to say, when he looked around, he didn't see too much, because not only he lacked the power to see, but he suddenly realized that he was abysmally ignorant of nature's laws, nature's ways, nature's plans. He had suddenly conceived that it was his right, his possible achievement, that he should create a way of life. This had never before occurred to him. Up to that time, he had been instructed that he was to live and die within a pattern established by antiquity, a pattern sustained and supported by the great institutions that overshadowed his individual thinking. And suddenly the infallibility of these institutions was shaken and they fell about him. And man emerged. Man emerged almost like a second Adam in a Garden of Eden. He emerged into a material world which challenged him in every direction, which captured his fascination, which began its insidious effect upon his total integration. Now we have to also recognize that the material world, to a measure, represents materialism. So we find that man, falling suddenly away from the clergy, suddenly falls into the grip of materialism as the antithesis of theology. Suddenly the individual, bewildered by the collapse of his gods and godlings, faced only a world that extended in the term of maps, rivers, and nations and boundaries. Most of all, he faced a world which he must build, in which he must find securities, he must create them. The natural result was a tremendous, if gradual, development of personal ambition. Little by little, the individual released an extremely powerful personal psychic urge, the urge to not only adjust to this earth, but to dominate it, to become master of it, to become the ruler of this planet upon which he dwelt. It certainly became the power, or at least the dream, of the simple man, the simple citizen, that he could become a builder of worlds. So Mephisto represents not only materialism as latent physical experience, but materialism as the rise of a great psychic temptation. The temptation to focus every resource upon matter. The temptation to place physical achievement before and above everything else. The temptation to accept as real only that which can be held in the hands. The temptation to forego the things of the spirit and to grasp the things of the body. By degrees, man's consciousness turned outward, leaving the abstract and ethical principles and clinging more and more to success, to physical achievement, to competition, and to the unfoldment of a positive and powerful, all-absorbing institution which we call progress. So Mephisto plays a series of roles. And as we study him in the play, we discover, for example, that Mephisto was apparently enjoying himself in a very comfortable and pleasant way in his own private, sulfurous abode. He was not at all anxious to become the servant of Faust, but Faust by magic invoked him. And the demon, because he must obey certain exorcisms, if they are properly given, was forced to come. And having arrived, like all good demons should, he made the best of a bad bargain. Never for one moment did he respect Faust. Never for a moment did he recognize Faust as anything but an arrogant fool. But Faust had the peculiar skill to control him according to ancient law, and Mephisto could wait his time, because he knew that the very process that Faust was using, this effort to grasp, control, and command by the sorcery of his mind, must ultimately end in Faust's destruction. In the end, Mephisto would take away the soul of the magician and carry it back to the regions from which he had come. So Mephisto could bide his time and wait until the proper moment. It was of no great importance anyway. So Mephisto plays along, And he has a nice way about him. When Faust is depressed, Mephisto cheers him up. He is always comforting, always giving good, bad advice, always recommending whatever Faust wants to do, and always available to help the magician achieve the impossible, ever remembering that each new achievement precipitated Faust nearer to the ultimate destruction. So that Mephisto had the subtle realization that regardless of what happened, he would win. That it was inevitable that this soul of Faust would ultimately be his. Now the third important person in our drama is Marguerite. And of course this character, more than any of the others, has been involved in numerous literary changes and adaptations. It is believed that the structure for her, as it occurs in the story by Goethe, is derived from an early romance that actually happened in the poet's life. But when he was about 16 years old, he fell in love with a beautiful girl by the name of Margaret, and she seems to have found her way into his story. The tie is apparently quite loose and inadequate, but actually a little more profound than we first imagined. Now when the great struggle for supremacy, when the powers of the world, whether they are vast combines, dictators, or whether they be great motions of industry and economics, upon whose head does the burden always fall? And the answer, of course, is what we would term the collective structure of society. Underneath the load of every generation stands the patient figure of the common man, who is the most uncommon of all men. Here we have, therefore, humanity. Here we have the world, which no matter who wins in the great battle of wits, the world must pay. The average human being must carry the responsibilities and consequences of all social change. And therefore, the betrayal of Marguerite simply represents a betrayal of the true psychic value in the life of collective humanity. In the story, then, to a great degree, Marguerite plays the part of the soul. For it is the soul that is always the victim of the ambitions of the mind and the schemes of the will. It is always the soul that must be crucified between the two thieves on every level of life and in every department of existence. So Marguerite represents the instinctive and natural nobility in human life, which is betrayed, and which is brought to madness and death by this conspiracy of powers with which our story is essentially concerned. Now to come a little more closely to our cast of characters, let us try to identify in the terms of the period these three characters just a little more specifically. Remember, this story was developed at a time originally when these elements had begun to clarify a wee bit. A man recognized three factors as fairly well distinguishable. By Faust, of course, we represent the human mind, reason. We represent the essential search for knowledge. We find the individual who is the basic thinker, essentially, naturally, normally, the truth seeker. In this case, the disillusioned truth seeker, suffering from what has been called the Faustian complex. In the character of Mephisto, we are therefore introduced, and I say this with hushed apology to the learned, we are introduced with the, we might say, skeletal archetypal form of what we call today science. Mephisto is science. Mephisto is that mysterious power of exact knowledge. the tremendous concept of the laboratory, the tremendous growing, unfolding power of creating a rational instrumentation for the achievement of the ambitions of mankind. So Mephisto appears as the embodiment or personification of skill, a method, which for its use and for its merits or demerits depends entirely upon the motives by which it is controlled. Man, for example, as Faust, by performing the correct exorcism, by using the words of power, by pronouncing them in their proper order, in other words, by following the rules exactly, can always demand the presence of power. He can always force skill to become his servant. But if in his ambition he perverts this skill to purposes which are not right or reasonable, this skill turns upon him and ultimately destroys him. Thus man, building science or making his bond with science after he rejects God, is rewarded by finally becoming the hopeless slave of his new master, who leads him inevitably into the fulfillment of the demoniacal pact. And this pact between reason or the human mind and the skill of science turns upon the common man, turns upon the collective, Marguerite, and produces such a phenomenon as the bombing at Hiroshima, in which hundreds of thousands perish as the result of the union of the human mind and scientific skill. Thus we have, long before the idea of a bomb ever came into existence, the recognition that the rise of skill, unsustained by integrity, unsupported by a vision of spiritual values, must ultimately lead to a pact being signed, a pact signed in blood. And as Mephisto says when he hands the pact to Faust, sign it in blood, for blood is a most peculiar essence. And this is exactly the case. And man has signed in blood the pact between mind and skill, and has turned this skill to the ravishing of his world, represented by his brutal treatment of Marguerite, her final madness and death. So here we have a little clearer concept of what Goethe was working with, and knowing the particular psychology of his time and the attitude of the German intellectual that was contemporary with Goethe, we know that this thought was prevalent in the minds of these people, and perhaps may have resulted in Goethe referring to Mephisto himself as a Junker, as a Prussian aristocrat, as one of a ruling class, because one of the unions of mind and skill was the creation of the great German military machine, which was already beginning to be intimated, to be suggested, even at the time of Goethe, and certainly was the object of a powerful exposition by Wagner in his metapolitical operatic productions. Now we have a little background for the problem, so we have to look for other directions for the moment. The basic story, which covers the prologue and the motivation of the drama of Faust, is almost completely borrowed from the Book of Job. And the Book of Job is probably one of the most mysterious books in the entire Bible, a book about which a great deal must be said, and it still remains as an enigmatical poem, because it presents to us the story of the God and the devil laying a pact for the soul of a good man. Now, in the story of Job, for example, Job is not an evil person. And when the afflictions come upon him, they are not due to the fact that he has disobeyed God, because he has not. They are due to the fact that God wishes to prove a point in a controversy with the devil. The Lord says that a good man will remain good, even under adversity. And the line occurs almost exactly in the prologue of Faust. Namely, that a good man in his adversity will cling unto the God who made him be. The devil says, no, you get the man miserable enough and he won't stay with God. He will depart into any escape that he can find. He will not stay true under infirmity. So in the story of Job, the Lord sends these infirmities which Job has to bear as best he can. And Job, for the most part, is patient, but he has his moments when patience almost ceases to be a virtue. And when he has the three celebrated comforters to assist him, he is well nigh undone. But Job finally does prove that God was right in having faith in Job, so that in the book it says, "The Lord blessed the later end of Job, and it was more fruitful and more glorious than the beginning." This is in substance the story of Faust. Faust was not subjected to all of these mysterious circumstances because he was a bad man. He was the person selected by the Lord and the devil to prove a point. And this in itself has made the entire story very difficult of explanation on a moral level. The moral seems to lie on the same level as that of the book of Job, in which the old biblical writer attempts to point out that these various problems and burdens that are sent to man are not sent to destroy him, but to test him, and to prove his merits and his worth, and to restore him ultimately to the kingdom of truth and righteousness. So, of course, in Faust, the prologue begins in a very beautiful heavenly place. And here all the cherubs and the angels are saying nice things about God, and are hymning him, and are adoring him, and are indicating all of their spontaneous and unquestioning obedience to the divine edict. And we have the wonderful lines that open the great poem: "The sun intones his ancient song, mid rival chant of brother spheres, his predestined path he thunders on in endless march throughout the years." And we also find that this wonderful thing, this wonderful song, unfolds its further glories, and the song tells us that angels are strengthened by its might, and all of these things, though fathom this mystery of light no angel may, resplendent are the orbs of light as on creation's primal day. Everyone's happy about everything. It's a wonderful time is being had by everyone in heaven. All but one. And that is Mephisto. Mephisto is standing by with a strangely cynical look on his face. Mephisto is a disillusioned man. And yet Mephisto is welcome at the heavenly court. He has not been cast down into the abyss. He is one of the brilliant angels of the Lord. But he is the one person present who dares to differ from the Lord, and also does not raise his voice in a happy song to the glad-eyed cherubim or anything of that nature. He thanks deity and applauds deity for having permitted a doubter like himself to be present, and then having sort of gotten his place in the sun and his opportunity to say something, Mephisto says, "Of worlds and suns I little have to say, I see alone man's self-inflicted pains, how this little world god still his stamp retains, as wondrous now as on the primal day. Better, alas, for him, poor white edgy, conceal the heavenly night. Reason, he names it, but doth use it so each day more brutish than the brutes doth grow. And this led to that little argument that led to the decision to test old Dr. Faust. Whether or not there was this good man who could not be touched by evil, even though he might come under a variety of temptations. And of this good man himself, we have later a simple introduction. He is in his laboratory. He hears outside the voices of young people, and he hears the bells that are symbols of a festive day. And poor old Dr. Faust is much the worse for years. The burden of time is heavy upon him. He has studied long and meditated much. He has watched his youth slip away in the quest of knowledge and of learning, but he has not found it. And he raises his lament. Woe is me, imprisoned in the gloom of this abhorred and musty room, where heaven's dear light itself doth pass but dimly through the painted glass. Old Faust is pretty well discouraged. Everything that he has ever sought, everything he has ever desired, his great search for truth, has been frustrated. Because Faust was, in his own right and proper person, an honest man. He wanted to know. He wanted to learn. But along had come, in some mysterious, intangible way, the heavy shadow of this thing we call the Reformation. The entire world of scholarship had been swept away, not by a single act alone, but by the changing psychology of man under the pressure of a new way of life. All these great and wonderful things, this proper scroll by Nostradamus' own hand, was not an all-sufficient guide. Nothing seemed to guide anything anywhere. And so Faust, in his dilemma, suddenly looks upon a wasted life, a life which is coming to an end, a life in which all the things that he might otherwise have had have been taken from him by the weight of his own years. He has not only given his life, but he has achieved nothing. He is with all his lore the fool no wiser than before, and there seems to be no way out. And obviously, under such pressures of circumstances, he is ready and eager to hazard some strange and magical spell with which to restore his failing life, with which to bring back the happy years that are gone, and give him an opportunity to live the life that he forsook in quest, in vain quest of knowledge and truth. Under such a condition as this, he was right ready to be right well tempted. And even this, however, was not forced upon him. He was not immediately tempted by some evil sprite. He must first of all demand this temptation. He must open himself to it. He must perform the rites and rituals which bring it. But out of his determination, he decided to form his pact with evil and to pay with his immortal soul for the privilege of the restoration of his physical estate. Now in here we have perhaps the entire drama of what we call today progress. Here we have man, a reasoning creature, possessing within himself a tremendous faculty of discrimination and research. We have man endowed wonderfully and richly with the powers to know. And we find that man, in spite of these powers, still remains ignorant. We see it today. We also see the troubles and trace them to the same source that had afflicted Faust. He had searched in the rubble and rubbish of ancient learning. He had read the works of other men and contemplated the old charges of magic and sorcery, and he had not found wisdom. He had discovered something that every man has to discover in the course of the search for wisdom, namely, that the mind can never know. Now, this was a hard blow for Faust. Probably he never placed it in words or even in articulate thought. But he was in the dilemma, nevertheless. The dilemma of having exhausted mentality without achieving wisdom. Now, the loss of this hope, the loss of this belief that he could learn to know, was further complicated by the prevailing skepticism of that time in which he lost spiritual orientation. He could no longer turn to God, because the concept of God had been riddled by the conflict on the level of theology. He could not have the faith that his own fathers had had. He could not resign himself to the simple moral or ethical codes of the church and go on without question. He was a thinker. And because he was a thinker, he was a doubter. And because he was a doubter, he lost one of man's most precious belongings, and that is the inner strength of faith. Having, therefore, no inward faith to lead him to truth, he did that which millions have done, hundreds of millions, in the following of the Faustian complex. He bartered faith for power. He made this, to him, fortunate transaction. If he could not, as the Duke of Gloucester says, in Richard II, if he cannot be the hero, he will be the knave. He is going to gain his end. And because he has lost his inner guidance, because he can no longer have this inner simplicity of the child heart, as Mencius calls it, he tries to force his way by the control of material or natural power. So Mephisto appears to him, not only in his famous red suit, but also in the guise which has tempted perhaps more mortals than any other appearance on earth, and that is the guise of temporal power. This is the same principle, again, as that which is said to have stood beside Jesus on the mountain overlooking the city, asking the Master to exchange the kingdom of heaven for the cities of the earth, tempting him. On which occasion Jesus said to the demon, "Get thee behind me, Satan." But Faust didn't say that. He ushered him in and made good friends with him immediately. Because here was what seemed to be the way out. And this is the way that all human beings have chosen, or most have chosen, particularly in this gradually rising materialism that has marked the interval between the 16th and the 20th century. Discouraged of being able to solve the mystery of himself, man has become content to attempt to solve the mystery of everything else. This has become his dream. And when you ask the individual, is he happy? He will answer, "Well, we will have interplanetary space stations almost any day now." Keeping his mind away from himself, man has tried to forget that he is the weakest link in his own chain, that his own ignorance of himself has never yet been corrected. And because he simply affirms that he does